Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Wow, what a weekend we all had, let alone what you do in your personal life. But if you look at the national news, we have a president of the United States en route to his criminal trial, and we have one of our great allies under attack. This happened all this weekend, and there's so many other things to talk about as it relates to 2024. This hour, we're going to be joined by Ariel Lightstone. He served as senior advisor to U.S. Ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, from 2017 to 2021, but a critical role in advancing the Abraham Accords. He's going to be with us, too. And Emily Schrader is standing by. She's an Israeli journalist, human rights activist based in Tel Aviv. So before we get to them, and of course, take your calls at 1-866-408-7669. Let me also mention that the Iraqi prime minister is here. There's a lot to discuss. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The top issue that Democrats have surrounding abortion heading into 2024 is that when we poll voters, only about 10 to 12% of them say abortion is my number one most important concern.
Very interesting. 2024 revealing polls, how Dems are playing abortion politics. The question is, what matters most to you and the rest of the nation's voters?
Number two.
My advice to the president today, for what it's worth, Mr. President, don't stop it. Support Israel. With respect, go to Amazon and buy a spine online.
Iran's historic attack. Israel weighs the response. Biden says take the win and enough. Only in Joe Biden's world can a 300 missile and drone attack be a success. Israel divided on their next move. We'll discuss.
Number one.
Everything about this case is, in my view, legally absurd. You know, this case is basically a state misdemeanor that had run out on the statute of limitations. You have this crazy case that's going to go forward.
That is Jonathan Turley, just stunned what we're all witnessing today. Trump trials, day one, case one. We look at Alvin Bragg's case, the defense, the jury selection, and why New York City and Dems should be embarrassed this is taking place at all, especially in a time in which we find that crime's still a huge problem, even though Alvin Bragg, he's the DA, actually bragging that violent crime is down. I doubt it all because I know the cops. They are not being incentivized to actually crack down on anyone because when they bring them in, risk their lives to do so in many cases, they're let out right away, unless you're Donald Trump. Remember, Alvin Bragg says, I'm only going to look people to put people in jail that have violent crimes. All right. Let me ask you something. What's violent about Donald Trump? Again, victimless crime. They're trying to make sure that he didn't have election interference when an incident took place allegedly in 2009. That they say may have affected the election in 2016 as he runs for president in 2024. So let's break this case down just a little bit. So what is the case and what is he being tried on? I mean, the case is pretty simple. They call it the hush money trial. They say Donald Trump has 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to cover up hush money payments to Stormy Daniels in the run-up to the 2016 election. Now, classified documents is waiting. The Republican, the January 6th trial is waiting. TBA on the Georgia trial. And now suddenly the most questionable trial of all, by far, wouldn't be tried for anybody else, is queued up and it's ready to go. So the former president accused of doing what he's doing. The allegations focus on payoffs to two women, Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal. And they said they had extramarital encounters with Trump years earlier. Okay, if that was an issue, FDR wouldn't have been president, JFK wouldn't have been president, and countless others, but I digress. As well as a Trump Tower doorman who claimed to have a story about a child he allegedly that Trump had out of wedlock. Nobody knows what he's talking about. No one knows who he's talking about, but that is evidently going to be in his case. Now, why am I speculating so much? Because they have not fully charged and told Trump what he's charged for. There's a felony charge. Prosecutors must show that Trump not only falsified or caused business records to be entered falsely, which would be a misdemeanor, but that he did so with an intent to commit or conceal a second crime. So you may ask yourself, what is the second crime? Ask yourself that, and guess what the answer is? We don't know. Nobody knows. Alvin Bragg did not specify the other crime, but He says, since the evidence shows his actions were meant to conceal state and federal campaign finance and tax crimes, some experts argue it could be an unusual legal strategy that very well could backfire. You think? Here's Jonathan Turley, cut four.
Everything about this case is, in my view, legally absurd. You know, this case is basically a state misdemeanor that had run out on the statute of limitations. And Bragg was forced, after he declined for a long time to bring this charge, to do so. His predecessor rejected it. You have this crazy case that's going to go forward, and it's going to turn on the testimony of people like Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen just recently had a judge call him a serial perjurer. Wow. And he's going to appear as the center of this case.
Right. So Michael Cohen. So it's not the first time somebody with a dicey background that served time in prison ends up being a witness. What you do is try to break people down like they're doing with the CFO of Trump Organization. And you try to get them when they're in Rikers Island to say, OK, I'll give up. Here's everything I know. So it's not unusual to have a dicey character be a key witness. But Michael Cohen especially has got a problem. Even after he took the plea deal and went to confinement, and now he's got to stay at a home confinement. Then he was just in a different prison. He got out. He then denied he did anything wrong. So here's a listen of Michael Cohen. It's built more for television, but let me just tell you, the first one's January 2017, 2 years later, 2019. Then we talk about what he said in 2016. Then what he says in 2019. Same thing, back and forth. What, Michael Cohen, do you believe? Cut three.
I will be in D.C. and in New York, anywhere Mr. Trump deems necessary. I'll be there.
I did not want to go to the White House. I was offered jobs.
Not only is Donald Trump not a racist, he believes that all people are part of one race, the human race.
I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist. He is a con man. And he is a cheat.
The words the media should be using to describe Mr. Trump are generous, compassionate, principled, empathetic, kind, humble, honest, and genuine.
He is capable of behaving kindly, but he is not kind. He is capable of committing acts of generosity, but he is not generous. He is capable of being loyal, but he is fundamentally disloyal.
Good luck with this guy, right? I mean, they didn't bring him to the White House for a reason. And it might have been a mistake in the long run because you want to keep, you know, this guy was very loyal to Trump, but he was not considered the best lawyer and the brightest guy. And Trump didn't bring him to the White House. Evidently, he felt really shunned. And number two, why the hell are they raiding his office to begin with? The president's president for a few weeks, and they're raiding his lawyer's office. I mean, just think about that for a second. I mean, it's not like he left office and Joe Biden's doing it. They did it while he was there. So what about picking a jury? How do you do it? You need 12 and you need six alternates. What do? You don't ask them if they voted for Trump. You know, you don't ask them. You don't ask them if they're a Democrat or Republican. You do ask them. You ever worked for Trump? You're part of the Boogaloo Boys. You're part of the Proud Boys. You're part of Antifa. I assume they're going to say no, 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 unless they want out. So you ever work for the Trump Organization? Can you function unbiasedly as a juror? Here's Kate Trukowski. She's a former federal prosecutor. She said this to Trey Gowdy last night. I love when lawyers talk to lawyers. Cut nine.
The judge in this case has already said that anybody who self-identifies as somebody that cannot be fair and impartial up front will not even be questioned further. So that will weed out a significant amount of people who are openly partisan, as it were. We want people who are going to be listening to the evidence in this case and understanding the very high burden of proof that the prosecution has here, because this is not an easy case for the prosecution. And people that are not openly political, obviously, is a significant factor here as well. So I believe jury selection is going to take a long time in this case. We'll see if they can get a fair jury.
And then Carrie Kopach Urban, who I think is a fantastic attorney, really knows Trump, too, says that she got some sources told her this thing's going to be done by Memorial Day. Wow, that's less than 6 to 8 weeks. And if you need a week and a half to do jury, so it could go quick. We'll see. Emily Schrader is going to be next. The Israeli journalist calling from Tel Aviv. Obviously, it's hectic over there. So rather than bring her on now, I'm going to give her a full segment after this break. And we'll talk about what has happened in that country, which is getting attacked from all sides. You are listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Glad you're here.
politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Naturally, I absolutely agree that we are victorious, and that we were victorious in this, but one has to also take into account that this was a very aggressive and brutal attack on Israel, and under the circumstances, I think the decision of the war cabinet, which is convening right now, will take into account all the measures that are required to defend and protect the people of Israel.
So that still doesn't tell us what exactly they're going to do, and that is Isaac Herzog. He's the Israeli president. Emily Schrader joins us now, Israeli journalist, human rights activist based in Tel Aviv. Emily, first off, how would you describe what was like in Tel Aviv over the weekend?
I mean, I think that the Israeli public was pretty much prepared for this. We had a lot of notice. There was a lot of chatter, of course, before the attack. And Iran has been saying they're going to destroy the state of Israel for many, many years. And so we are somewhat used to this sort of state of heightened alert. And I, you know, I have to applaud the IDF and the state of Israel for being so on top of things and ensuring that there was no panic. There was no major, you know, rush to the supermarkets or, you know, the things you usually see in a wartime situation. It was business as usual. We're getting the job done. We're dealing with what we have to do, and that's what we'll continue to do.
But it is not business as usual, as you know better than anybody, because Iran's hitting Israel, trying to, for the first time ever, from their soil, not hiding behind proxies and have plausible deniability for any would-be attack. So now with 300 drones, rockets, ballistic missiles, and cruise missiles heading the direction, do you believe that President Biden – Prime Minister Netanyahu should take President Biden's recommendation and take the win? Or do you believe they have to answer militarily?
Well, first of all, I do think that this is a historic failure on the part of the Islamic Republic. I mean, 99% of the projectiles that they sent over, you know, to harm, to maim and injure Israeli civilians, by the way, not military targets, but civilians, were shot down. And so that is an incredible success. That is a win for the Israeli Air Force and, of course, our allies in the United States, UK, and even Jordan. That being said, of course, Prime Minister Netanyahu should not take President Biden's advice to exercise restraint and to, quote unquote, take the win. This is not how you deter a terrorist regime. This is not how you prevent a further escalation in war, especially with an enemy that has been pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into terrorist proxies on every single border of the state of Israel. So no, absolutely not. Israel must respond and must respond forcefully. Now, what that looks like militarily, I can't tell you that. I don't really know what the inner workings are in terms of the strategy, but I know that there are a lot of options that were presented to the cabinet and that they have made some decisions about what will be going forward, and it remains to be seen what that will be.
Roughly 50% of the ballistic missiles fired by Iran failed to launch or crash before reaching their target. And when they started coming over, it looks like the U.S. has knocked out 80. And at least six ballistic missiles. They did shoot from Iraq, Iran, and Yemen, but they did not shoot from Hezbollah, did not have an array of rockets where that would have been, I guess, problematic. Overall, do you think that was when Iran comes out afterwards and said, that's it, we're done, that was to say, okay, we're even? Do you think that that was significant, that Hezbollah didn't get involved, Hamas didn't get involved, and they quickly put out a statement that it's over?
Well, I think it's, in a way, it's funny that the immediate response of the Islamic Republic is, okay, we're done. You don't get to start a war as a sovereign country, fire over 300 projectiles at civilians, as I mentioned, and then say, okay, just kidding, we're done. That's not how it works. As I said, this is not the beginning of the conflict with the Islamic Republic. They've been doing this via proxy for many years, albeit an escalation, since this is the first time we've seen it from Iranian soil itself. Hezbollah actually has been firing rockets sporadically in the last few days as well, not what they have the capacity to do. Remember, they have almost 250,000 missiles that are stocked up there on the border of Israel, and so they didn't go full on. I think that this is something that the Islamic Republic is trying to, a card that they're not quite ready to play, because I do think that they expect there to be an escalation. And I think that is something that at some point they want. Now, I don't think that they want it right now, or they would have done it. I think that right now the Islamic Republic is very, very weak, much weaker than what they're letting on. And even if you look at the internal situation on the ground in Iran, I mean, this week, another form of war has been launched against their own people. I mean, they just launched a huge crackdown on women in Iran over the hijab issue. They brought back the morality police. There are videos circulating everywhere of them dragging women and girls into these vans that kicked off the protests last year. So they're facing tremendous opposition internally as well. They don't want to add fuel to that fire, believe me, because if strikes start going internally in the country, and if protests start rising up, the Islamic Republic is going to have a terrible time controlling the situation. It's very volatile right now. And for that reason, I think it's incredibly important that Israel take a decisive action sooner rather than later when it comes to deterring the Islamic Republic.
So I want you to hear what Michael McCall, he's chairman of foreign relations, said he'd recommend. Cut 26.
I think a proportionate response here. I think one option would be to take out the facilities where these drones and rockets came from and also destroy the manufacturing facilities that build the drones and rockets, not just for Israel's sake, but also for Ukraine's sake. Because
your thoughts, does that sound plausible? Does that sound proportionate?
I think it sounds proportionate, of course, but there are some logistical issues. The Islamic Republic did intentionally fire rockets from heavily populated areas, as we know them and their terrorist proxies do. We see the same tactics in the Gaza Strip. And so there is a civilian consideration that must be taken into account. That being said, there have been mysterious explosions at some of the manufacturing facilities in recent months, and I wouldn't be surprised if there are more mysterious explosions in those. I definitely think those are legitimate targets. He mentioned for the sake of Ukraine, but also for the sake of all the West. I mean, the Islamic Republic has been very clear that their enemy is not just Israel, it's the entire West, it's the United States, you know, what they call the Great Satan. And so there is an agenda here from this regime to target United States as well. Our fight in Israel, here in Israel, is also your fight in the United States. And I think that's really right. Important to remember. In terms of striking other targets in the Islamic Republic, obviously Israel has a list of priorities of things they would like to target, the most obvious being the nuclear facilities. Now, logistically, I don't know what all that entails in terms of bunker busters and being able to effectively target those sites, but I do know that that, of course, is a high priority for the state of Israel and really for the world.
Emily Schrader, thanks so much. Appreciate that perspective from Tel Aviv. Ariel Lighthouse, Lightstone next. He is also a key member of Ambassador Friedman's staff. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
President Biden is wrong telling Israel that they shouldn't respond. Imagine America getting 300 drones and missiles shot at our homeland and having a country telling us not to respond. Now, it's up to Prime Minister Netanyahu and his war cabinet and ultimately the elected government and people of Israel about how and when they respond. It's hard to imagine this doesn't steal their resolve to finish the job against Hamas in Gaza or to refuse to tolerate Hezbollah, Iran's proxies to its north in Lebanon, possessing more than 100,000 rockets and missiles and drones on its own, and ultimately to tolerate Iran with a nuclear weapon. Imagine what last night would have looked like if Iran was shooting nuclear-armed missiles into Israel.
And I talked to three-star General David Perkins today, and he says that if they had nuclear weapons, he thinks they would have used them last night, which is something to think about because if they had them, how close are they to getting them? And this is an irrational regime. Even last night when they're trying to send a message, they would have used nuclear weapons. That according to a general that spent years in that neighborhood. Aria Lightstone joins us now. He serves as senior advisor to U.S. Ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, from 2017 to 2021. He also played a critical role in the Abraham Accords. Aria, welcome to Brian Kilmeade Show. Thanks for joining us.
Brian, thank you for having me.
First off, what do you think about Senator Cotton, as I mentioned, General Perkins, assuming that if they had nuclear weapons, they would have used them over the weekend?
Oh, absolutely, they would have used them. They are not looking for them for, you know, ornaments to put on their tree. They say death to Israel, death to America, and that is a tool to accomplish that goal.
So it would be pretty amazing if they did, first time since the 40s, since we dropped them, but we'll see. Looking at that attack over the weekend, we got all these different things. We had 300, they say it would be 300 strikes. It looks like we knocked down, the U.S. knocked down about 80. The U.K. has said they knocked down some. France played a role, and so did Jordan. Does that show you that Israel has a lot of friends, especially in this region?
I think it shows that Israel has a lot of countries near it that have their interests. If the United States and the UK and France did not participate, again, when the US leads, others will follow, then maybe some more missiles would have gone through, and then Israel would have had no choice but to get into a full shooting war with Iran, which certainly the United States of America doesn't want now. Now, Jordan is the fascinating one. Jordan, Israel have a hate-hate relationship. Frenemies would be overstating it. But Jordan shot down more than 10 projectiles that flew over their territory, and they did it because it's a Jordan-first policy. You cannot shoot missiles over my country and allow me to allow them to go through. And so Jordan did what was in Jordan's interest, even though they took a risk standing up for Israel in that case.
Because they have such a Palestinian population, right? Including his wife.
Yeah, especially his wife. More than 70% of the Jordanian population is Palestinian.
So where were you over the weekend?
I was in my house in Israel with four kids and my wife, and put the kids to sleep in the bomb shelter, as we were all too familiar with from October. And the kids had one of these looks of not again, and sat there. My wife was able to sleep. I'm not sure how. And I watched in slow motion a sovereign nation, Iran, attack the country that I live in, Israel. And the United States of America sort of demur in terms of what Israel's response should be.
In what respect? I mean, Joe Biden said, take the win, don't hit back. If you do hit back, we're not going to support you. And the fact is, we know that. That's not a rumor. They basically said that. Your reaction to that stance?
My reaction to that stance is it's very unclear why Joe Biden seems to be rooting for Hamas and Iran and against Israel. It seems incredibly un-American. Certainly, it's it boggles your mind in terms of his moral compass.
He says, well, listen, I knocked all those rockets out of the skies. I killed off all those drones. What do you mean I'm against Israel?
Yeah, again, I think in his interest in not to have a larger shooting war, he absolutely did that. And the military-to-military relationship remains strong and is getting stronger. Where Israel loses out is the lack of clarity that the United States of America possesses. And just to give you an example, on day number one of Biden coming into office, he's allowed the spigot to turn on and has created billions, not billions, tens of billions of dollars to go to Iran, which is funding Hamas and Hezbollah. And we've failed at every turn to sanction even the malign parts of Iran, which is the drone system and the ballistic missile system. And we could have sanctioned them. He chose not to sanction them. And that's exactly what attacked Israel.
So when you say he has allowed billions to get in, he's allowing to sell oil to Iran. He's allowed funds to be unfrozen from South Korea, and he's allowed electricity dollars from Iraq to flow into Iran. Is that basically what you're talking about? Is there more?
There's even more than that. The only deal to be brokered under the Biden administration in the Middle East was a deal in between Iran and Saudi Arabia. How preposterous is that? That the United States of America could not even have the influence over Saudi Arabia. China came in to broker that deal. So China has now secured China, Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia as infinite energy security for them. And the United States of America is once again sitting on the outside watching our enemies get stronger and our allies become weaker.
So here's Marco Rubio. He also agrees with you. He would play a prominent role should Donald Trump get elected, maybe even as his running mate. Cut 24.
By the way, the so ceasefire now people who were out yesterday cheering the launch of hundreds of rockets and drones and missiles against Israel. People that are out there cheering military attacks of this scale and scope are not peace activists. These are anti-Semites, anti-Israel, pro-terrorist elements out there. And we need to stop calling them peace activists. They are not peace activists. You don't, peace activists do not cheer massive attacks against other countries, which is what they were doing yesterday. So I guess this is part of the White House's effort to appease them by putting this out there proactively.
Leading Benny believe that he's putting pressure on Israel because he's worried about losing Michigan and elements of Minnesota, Wisconsin.
Marco is absolutely correct. Senator Rubio, the only piece that he didn't add is not only are they not peace activists, they hate America. The people who are chanting for this are very excited to cheer for the people who say death to Israel. The sentence never ends with death to Israel. It goes death to Israel, death to America. Senator Cotton, who you led the show with, was at the very, very forefront of saying if Israel does not defeat Iran, Iran will ultimately come for America.
Sorry, so what is going to be going on? Bring us behind the scenes. What do you imagine is happening? Evidently, the president and the prime minister do not get along. And he basically told them, if you go hit Iran, you do it alone, and you think you're going to lose a lot of support if you go attack. Does the prime minister have to listen?
The prime minister does not have to listen, but the prime minister has to make decisions that are in the best interest of Israel. And one of the decisions that's in the best interest of Israel is to keep the United States of America as close as humanly possible. The rest of the world can have whatever secret weapons they have. Israel's secret weapon has always been closeness with no daylight with the United States of America. What President Obama did and what President Biden has followed in his footsteps has created daylight in between the United States of America and Israel. And when that daylight exists, bad guys take advantage of that. In this case, it's Iran. Prime Minister Netanyahu is backed into a corner. I don't believe he can face his people without either finishing Gaza, pushing Hezbollah off the northern border in Lebanon, or a direct attack on Iran, or possibly all three.
Well, first things first, he says, I have a date for the Rafah campaign. Do you believe he does? And do you believe it's necessary? And do you think the terrorists, those two battalions, are still there, Hamas battalions?
Yeah, there are at least four battalions left within Gaza, and they all need to be defeated because it would be like surrounding Germany and letting the Nazis go ahead and regroup in Berlin. It would be a completely and totally unnecessary loss of all the people who have sacrificed up to this point in time to not finish the job. And even more than that, the people who claim that they are rooting for the Palestinians, they should be the number one people rooting for Israel to kill Hamas. Because if Hamas comes back and they take over control over Gaza, so what's the life going to be like for the, quote, good Palestinians in Gaza? Of course it's going to be hell because their leaders are going to be people who want to make it hell. So they need to be defeated. And all of this is we still have five Americans who are hostages there. How is it possible that we're not focused on getting them back with every ounce of our being?
So, Aria, how many hostages do you think are left? I'm hearing some stories that there might only be 20.
Yeah, it pains me greatly because I've met with almost all of the families of the hostages. And to look them in the eyes, I think that they know in their heart of hearts that most of their close ones are not with us any longer. And you should just know that Hamas has kept bodies hostages since 2014. Even after they're gone, even after they're dead, even after they announce that they're dead, refuse to return the bodies in order to be able to have a funeral with dignity. So we're not dealing with normal people. We're not even dealing with people who I think have any level of moral compass. So they need to be dealt with that way.
Well, should that play a role in how you fight in Rafah? And do you believe that the humanitarian corridors will be abused by Hamas, who's going to pretend as if they are innocent Palestinians?
Yeah, well, we know that that's the case, because when they evacuated south, they took advantage of that. When they'll evacuate back north, they'll take advantage of that also. Most of this is preposterous, because why should Palestinians who want to get out of the way of the war not be able to? Why haven't we put our pressure on Egypt in order for Palestinians who don't want to be in Gaza right now to be able to leave through Egypt? There are plenty of other countries who've been willing to take them. on a temporary basis so that way they can get out of the war. Hamas has demanded that they stay there, and the West has acceded to Hamas's demand in order to have as many civilian deaths as humanly possible to put pressure on Israel.
Here's what Michael Waltz says is the danger of the de-escalation rhetoric. Cut 29.
The fundamental mistake, the fundamental underpinning, has been an appeasement strategy from the Biden administration that's so focused on what they call de-escalation that it has signaled to the region and certainly to Iran that they have room to push, that they can achieve their goals. Just last year, we refused to push the UN to renew sanctions on Iran's drone and missile program. Now they're literally flying towards Israel.
So he has a legitimate worry?
Oh, it's a tremendous worry. And this is all seen in advance from Cotton to Waltz. They see that the weaker America is, the more people go ahead and take advantage of that. There is no reason for Hamas to agree to a ceasefire because the United States of America is arguing on their behalf. When the United States of America says we must cease fire no matter what, without any linkage to the returning of the hostages, explain to me why Hamas would offer up anything less than that.
Do you think things would be different under Trump, or were they different under Trump?
They certainly were. We had five peace treaties in 123 days. ISIS went from a caliphate the size of Ohio to being non-existent relic of history. Radical Islam was confronted by the Islamic countries who were told by President Trump, you deal with it or I will deal with it. America was certainly much more secure because we had a southern border. And almost more importantly than all of that is because we were energy independent. When the United States of America showed up in the Middle East, we didn't show up as equals. We showed up as a superpower. And now when we show up in the Middle East, we need something from the Middle East, and they know that. So they sense our weakness. And none of this would have happened under Donald Trump. And had the war happened under Donald Trump, the war would have been over, the war would have been shorter, and the hostages would be home already.
Aria Lightstone joins us from Israel. So could you tell us, the people outside your country, the politics of it? People say, well, Netanyahu is just holding on because he wants to extend his political power. He knows as soon as the conflict ends, he's going to be out of a job. But would Benny Gantz, who seems to be the front runner to take on Netanyahu, would he be running a different war? Does he have a different philosophy?
My 23-year-old next-door neighbor doesn't have a different philosophy. There's no difference in between the left, the right, and the center in Israel right now. Everybody is united in making sure that something like October 7th does not happen again. Everybody is united in making sure that Israel is able to be strong and secure and confident on its own in order to live in, as you can see in real time, a very rough neighborhood. What's important for the audience to be able to see, we've got something in America called the Trump derangement syndrome. There's the Bibi derangement syndrome, that the rest of the West has decided that somehow this is Bibi's war. It's not Bibi's war. Hamas started a war against Israel. Any leader of Israel would prosecute or persecute this war in pretty much exactly the same way. But people want to separate Bibi from Israel so they can claim to be anti-Bibi without being anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. It's just baloney.
And Aria, the other big picture I think you should clarify, it's not Bibi Netanyahu who's walking away from a two-state solution. The Palestinians don't want to do two-state solution. Hamas wins every election. They're the most popular unit. So it's not like they're keeping the Palestinian people hostage. On the surface, there's no partner for a two-state solution because the other guys don't want it, correct?
On the surface, underneath the surface, and above the surface, there is no partner for a two-state solution. Gaza was given to the Palestinians in 2005 with full rein to do with whatever they want on the most beautiful coastline on the entire Mediterranean. They took that with billions of dollars. Do you know that there are more hospitals per capita in Gaza than in any other Arab country in the entire world? Do you know why they had those hospitals? Because they are secretly military bases. There's been more dollars poured into Gaza than any other country in the Arab world on a per capita basis, and it doesn't go to the people. It goes to tunnels. It goes to rockets. It goes to terrorism because the leadership do not want to live in peace with Israel. They want to scam the West. They want to abuse their people, and they want to murder Israelis. That's what they want.
Absolutely. And they built 500 miles worth of tunnels. And the most precious tunnels are the ones waiting in Rafah. Hopefully you guys can gut them. Thanks so much, Aria Lightstone. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, listen, we come back. I'll be able to squeeze in some calls. We're also, President Trump has just spoken. Had a few remarks. He's obviously ticked off that he's got to go to this selection for the jury on his criminal fate. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Historic day. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
President Biden met with Japan's prime minister where they discussed building a new bullet train system in America using advanced Japanese technology. In return, Japan requested the advanced American technology of forks.
It's pretty funny. It was
a good one.
I thought it was the SNL, as I was mentioning on the live, hit. They laughed through the whole thing.
They do. We have a little piece of it, which we don't have time for here. But I mean, if you didn't see it, you're not going to know. It's very visual. But also all of just the different double entendres they use are hilarious.
Yeah, it was actually pretty funny. And they stayed apolitical. And who was the host again?
Oh, my goodness. Ryan Gosling and then Kate McKinnon. They sort of like brought back, I think, one of the skits they've done in the past where they were abducted by aliens. And they were just cracking up the entire time.
Right. Well, she's genius.
She is.
Kate McKinnon is so much better than everybody else. I think the best one ever to be on that show.
Yeah, I agree with you. Her level of talent is extraordinary.
I mean, what does someone like that do now? I mean,
she's in movies. She's in a lot of things. She was in the Barbie movie as well. I know. I'm sure you saw it. But she's in a good amount of things. I think she also voices a lot of animated shows or movies. I'm sure she's busy. I'm sure she's not sitting on her, you know, couch.
I always worry. I think that. Keenan has it right. He's like, what is better than this?
Yeah.
And it's Colin Jost. I'm sure they're just trying to find a late night slot for him.
But
don't
he's
think?
So good on Weekend Update with Michael Che.
I know, they're but how much longer would he do it? I mean, this has got to be an all-time record. It's got about 6 or 7 years.
I know, but the two of them are, I mean, look at Seth Meyers. Like, eh.
I know. That's what I'm saying. If there was an opening, I'm sure they would put him in there.
I think we should stay where he is, though.
Okay.
Top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Welcome back, everyone. Brian Kilmeade Show. Thanks so much for being here. Hope you had a good weekend, but man, it was tumultuous. If you think about the trial that's starting now and you think about the attacks that took place over in Israel, it's impossible to avoid. The whole world was watching. Michael Goodwin standing by. Stephen Mosher at the bottom of the hour. Really important to have him on today because it was revealed over the weekend that China is now providing armaments and backing up and filling in any needs that Russia has in their war with Ukraine. I'm not talking about buying oil. I'm talking about actual armaments. I thought we warned them not to do that. And now it was intentionally told to journalists that they are doing that. So Stephen Mosher's got a brand new book called The Devil in the Communist China, From Mao Down to President Xi. He's going to be with us on that. And we know the prime minister of Iraq is now in Washington, D.C., meeting with our president. A lot going on. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The top issue that Democrats have surrounding abortion heading into 2024 is that when we poll voters, only about 10 to 12% of them say abortion is my number one most important concern.
Well, that's interesting. 2024 revealing polls, how Dems are playing abortion politics. The question is, what matters most to you and the rest of the nation and the voters?
Number two.
My advice to the president today, for what it's worth, Mr. President, don't. Stop it. Support Israel. With respect, go to Amazon and buy a spine online.
And they can deliver in the same day. Senator John Kennedy, Iran's historic attack. Israel weighs their response. Biden says he'll take the win to Israel. Only in Joe Biden's world can a 300-missile drone and missile attack be a success. Israel divided on the next move. We'll discuss it.
Number one.
Everything about this case is, in my view, legally absurd. You know, this case is basically a state misdemeanor that had run out on the statute of limitations. You have this crazy case that's going to go forward.
You do, Jonathan Turley. He's seen it all, but never seen anything like this. Trump trials, day one, case one. We look at Alvin Bragg's case, the defense and jury selection, and why New York City and Democrats should be embarrassed that this is taking place at all, especially with what this city needs and how much it is costing. So we have a lot to discuss here today, including those attacks. But I want to talk about this trial first and foremost. And with that, let's bring in Michael Goodwin. The president of the United States spoke a short time ago, made a few statements that this never should have been happened, this is a sham, and that he's proud to take the hit for all of us. Michael, welcome back.
Good morning, Brian. Thank you.
I mean, think about the priorities of New York City and how much this is going to be costing over the next 6 to 8 weeks. This blows me away, especially when Cy Vance, the previous Manhattan district attorney, refused to take this case. This is what he said. Cut two.
I think it's public record that we commenced an investigation at around the same time as the Southern District of New York did. We were asked by the Southern District of New York to stand down. We did stand down for probably over a year. And then it got to the point where Michael Cohen was indicted and pleaded guilty, and then it stopped. So that was one reason why we didn't move forward at the beginning.
And then he went on to say they didn't see enough for the case. How do you think this plays out?
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, honestly, Brian, I don't know how it's going to play out. I think it's going to cut both ways. The question is which way predominates. And obviously, President Trump is, you know, got a view of this that I think resonates with a lot of not just his supporters, but with a lot of fair-minded Americans who, you know, they like their politics balanced. They have an instinctive dislike of things that tilt too far, that are too obvious. You don't even have to know the facts, all the facts, to understand that a case involving hush money with a porn star back in 2016, you know, I mean, the actual event, if it happened, even precedes that by several years. But the idea that somehow this is a felony today just doesn't make sense. It doesn't pass the smell test. And then you further go on to, well, who brought this case? Alvin Bragg. Who is Alvin Bragg? What does he stand for? Well, we know he doesn't like to prosecute anybody. He's one of those George Soros prosecutors who thinks all criminals are just misunderstood and they have a right because society is mean. That's who Alvin Bragg is. And as you played the clip from Vance, he goes on to say that they turned it down because they didn't think there was enough there. It was the pressure after Vance left office on Bragg, who succeeded him. It was the pressure on Bragg from the far leftists, some of whom worked for Robert Mueller and who were dying to get Trump on something. And don't forget this. And the Georgia case and the civil case in New York and the two civil cases, the one brought by Letitia James, the other one, the defamation case brought by E. Jean Carroll, all of these were designed to get Trump on something that he couldn't be pardoned for or that he couldn't pardon himself for. All these are state cases. And that's the origin of these things. Let's get Trump. Let's get him on something that he can't wiggle out of with a pardon. And let's use whatever ammunition, whatever resources it takes, it doesn't matter. This is a get Trump operation.
So there's right now the Alvin Bragg says they have one felony charge. Prosecutors must show that Trump not only falsified or caused business records to be falsified, which would be a misdemeanor, but he did so with the intent to commit or conceal a second crime. And then they were asked, Bragg, well, what is the other crime? What is the other crime? And right now they have not revealed what the other crime is. Michael Cohen said we have a surprise, which is nuts. William Scharf, one of the Trump attorneys, said this to Shannon yesterday. Cut seven.
At the end of the day, what we're talking about here is a show trial. It's a six-week-long media extravaganza in the media capital of the world, where the only realistic consequence, even if President Trump were convicted, is frankly a talking point for the Biden campaign.
So he's dismissive of it. Here's a little more. Cut eight.
I truly believe the truth is on President Trump's side, and there's nothing that any of these witnesses or anything the New York DA can do to change that basic fact. If these were merely misdemeanors, there's no question the statute of limitations would not allow this case to have been brought in the first place.
So that's what he's going to be fighting against. And they said, you know, Andrew Weissman said that he's got a lot of respect for Trump's attorneys. I hope they're able to do their job.
Well, look, as we said in the beginning, Brian, there's a lot riding on this, of course, in terms of the campaign. Unless the prosecutors bring something that is really clear, a felony, I mean, not 34 misdemeanors, but a felony. That's the alchemy here that nobody has seen, that how Bragg turns this into a felony. One suspicion, of course, is that it's going to involve federal campaign finance laws. But he doesn't have any authority to bring a case under federal campaign finance laws. So it really is a mystery. But the fact that it's a mystery undercuts the very idea that it's important or that it's significant enough to do this. I mean, prosecutors turn down cases all the time for various reasons. We saw that with Robert Hur and Joe Biden, right? The prosecutor's right to say, look, I can't win at trial. Right. This man will not be convicted of a case I could bring, therefore I'm not going to bring the case. Prosecutors make those decisions all the time. Alvin Bragg makes this decision on the basis, this is New York. I can get a jury that will convict Donald Trump of anything. All I have to do is find some way to stitch together an argument that will pass the smell test, and I can get a conviction. I think that's a lot of what this is about.
It might be decided this week because this is when they pick the jury. We watch the president's caravan leave the Trump Tower, take the FDR Drive, and then come into the surface streets of the courtroom. I imagine we're going to get used to that over the next 6 weeks. So we'll see, because picking that jury has got to be tough where the president only got 12% of the vote in Manhattan. They couldn't move it. They couldn't move the judge, even though the judge's daughter is a Democratic activist. One of his clients is Adam Schiff. And may or may not have had a website, anti-Trump website. Here's Jonathan Turley, cut five.
Well, it's going to be a challenging jury. It's easier to find a stray manatee in Manhattan than someone who's an actual Trump supporter. This is one of the most hostile jurisdictions to Trump, and that's going to be reflected in the jury pool. They're not going to be asked about their political leanings, so he can assume that he's going to have a motivated judge and a fairly hostile jury. And that's one of the things that I think Alvin Bragg is counting on. This is an absurd case, and he's counting on the fact that the jury may not demand a lot once they see who's sitting behind the defense table.
So, I mean, and this guy's seen it all. He teaches at George Washington University, so he's not too optimistic. I just think it's also a good point to bring up what Jeb Bush said. He says he's not a pro-Trumper. I don't know if anyone remembers, but he said... He sums up the pushback that everyone's giving. He says, Bush tweeted this out. Bragg's predecessor, which is you, didn't take up the case. The Justice Department didn't take up the case. Bragg first said he would not take up the case. This is very political, not a matter of justice. In this case, let the jury be the voters. So he's saying, I don't really like the guy, but this is ridiculous. I hope that is the case, that people look at this and say, is this really happening?
Well, you know, Brian, Jeb Bush is exactly the kind of person I'm thinking of here. Jeb Bush hates Donald Trump. I mean, the whole Bush family, I think we can safely say, pretty much with one exception, the young guy down in Texas, they're all virulently anti-Trump. But this thing offends any sense of fairness yep. and justice. And I think that's what that is the only hope I think that Donald Trump has of escaping conviction in this case. Of course, there will be appeals, and hopefully the New York State judiciary will not become as partisan as it often is and look at this legally, because this is a precedent. Don't forget, this is the first former president ever to go on criminal trial. And that's been my argument about all of these cases. There's something fundamentally wrong with all of the cases against Donald Trump. And if you're going to make history, you better get your ducks in order. It better be a perfect, airtight argument, not just legally, but politically. You have to say this is so egregious that it's worth indicting a former president. Because, you know, once the cat is out of the bag, there's going to be a tit for tat. And Joe Biden better watch his butt, because when he leaves office, why shouldn't he be indicted by some state prosecutor somewhere? That's the barrier the Democrats have broken repeatedly, and I think they're going to rue the day.
So just real quick, the Siena poll asked people what they think of Trump in 2020 compared to 2024. Approve of his handling of the economy, up 10 in 4 years. Think he left the country better off, plus 9 in 4 years. Approve of his handling of maintaining law and order, 8, up 8. Approve of handling of unifying America, plus 4. Approve of handling COVID, now plus 3. So they're looking back at 2016 and 2020, and they like it more. And this, think electing him is a safe choice. Now that's up 11.
Well, of course, the reason is that not only maybe some memories soften with time, but we have a clear comparison with Joe Biden. And nobody thinks Joe Biden is doing a great job. And so you look back at Trump and you say, wow, things were better. Yeah, we got a lot of mean tweets and nasty things, but the country was better off when Donald Trump was president. I think it's by almost any measurement, that is true. And I think that's why I think the Democrats have misplayed whatever chance they have for Biden's reelection. They've turned it into something that doesn't ring true. And, I mean, Biden's defense of the border, the economy, oh, it's working. Biden, inflation is gone. I inherited great inflation. I mean, none of that is true. And, you know, Americans, a lot of people don't pay attention to politics in the way that you or I do, or we wish more people would. But they still have a basic sense of smell, of what smells right and what smells true. And the Biden argument for reelection doesn't smell right as though it's true.
All right, Michael Goodwin, thanks so much. You catch all his articles in the New York Post. I appreciate it, Mike.
My pleasure. Thank you, Bob.
All right, your turn next. 1-866-408-7669. Then I tell you why China should be celebrating today. It's more distraction from the Pacific, where we wanted to put most of our assets. Don't move.
Diving deep into today's top stories, it's Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I think it really demonstrates how it's astonishing that we are not standing firmly with Israel, and there should never be any kinds of conditions on all that. When a nation can launch hundreds of drones towards Israel, and I'm not going to be talking about conditions ever.
I love it. Senator Fetterman 100% agrees with people like Marco Rubio, Tom Cotton, Lindsey Graham. Why are you, if you do want to say to Prime Minister Netanyahu, hey, listen, might want to rethink it. Let's give it 48 hours. Don't let that come out in a biography 2 years from now. But within minutes, when I was on the air on Saturday night, they just said, Mark Levin says there's an NBC report that says that the Prime Minister being told by President Biden, do not respond, do not retaliate. Why would you do that? And they're concerned that he's going to overreact and going to not think it through. Like they said, the killing of those commanders of the IRGC over in Damascus. I wouldn't label that. I thought they pre-thought it. To me, you don't just get up in the morning and try to kill these guys. The Al-Quds guy showed up right next door. You take him out. Steve, listen on WABC. Hey, Steve.
Yes, my main point in a second, but to respond to Michael Goodwin, the one thing is when Joe is out of office, he'll be in his pleasure palace in China because he's Manchurian Joe, and he'll be retiring where he's beyond the jurisdiction of American law.
He won't. He'll retire in Rehoboth. He's always going to be he was being protected when he was a former vice president, and he was getting Secret Service protection. I don't think if Donald Trump wins this election, I don't think he's going after Biden. I really don't think he's doing retribution. I think it's get back in action because, number one, he's been thinking about it since the day he lost. Number two, there is so much to do. How the hell can you have your Justice Department going after a former president when you have so much going on in this country, crime running out of control? We don't have enough prisons for all these people. We've got to reinvigorate the cops and empower the cops. And do the best they can to bring law and order to the major cities like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Chicago, and, of course, New York City. I don't see him doing it, even though he would have it coming to him, judging by everything that's going on right now. Remember, this lead attorney, Matt Colangelo, was in the Justice Department of Joe Biden and left to run this case. Don't say there's no links there. Steve Mosher is next.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Why is China using this moment to help Russia with its war in Ukraine?
Well, I think they realize that Russia, the outcome of this war, Russia against Ukraine, is critical for their own decisions with Taiwan and the Western Pacific. This is all connected. Iran, Ukraine, China. The stock of Ukrainian ammunition is dwindling. They're going to run out of ammunition. Russia's capacity, we look at this all the time, is going up. With the help of China, Russia can win this. If we support Ukraine, Ukraine can win. We passed an emergency supplemental 2 months ago. It's sitting on the speaker's desk. He should bring that to the floor tomorrow night, get it passed.
So that is Senator Mark Kelly, Democrat from Arizona, talking about the need to get some type of supplemental out there. You got to do something in Congress. I mean, standalone aid for Ukraine, standalone aid for Israel, standalone for Taiwan, whatever. You got to get it done. But yet you have people on the extreme right who say Ukraine shouldn't be funded because Eastern Europe is so far away. Even Senator J.D. Vance is out to lunch on this. I don't know. And he keeps changing the reason why he's out. Now he says, that's too far away. It's not an immediate concern for us, Ukraine. Israel is, we're much closer friends. Okay, so because the Middle East, in his view, is closer and means more than Eastern Europe. So just give up Eastern Europe. Steve Mosher joins us now, president of the Research Institute, best-selling author of his latest book, is now out, The Devil and the Communist China, From Mao to Xi. Steve, welcome.
Good to be back with you, Brian.
We warned China, don't provide armaments to Russia. Last week, they said they did. They are. I mean, it's been revealed to the press. Our intelligence says they're backing up Russia. Your thoughts?
Yeah, of course they are. I mean, look, China's been backing up Russia from the very beginning. They backed up Russia before the Ukrainian invasion by signing a half dozen trade and economic exchange agreements. They're building pipelines from Russia to China so that China can buy Russian natural gas and petroleum products. They've been sending spare parts for Russian tanks and armored personnel carriers and the rest from the very beginning. And there's some evidence that even early on that they were sending munitions. And by the way, North Korea, which is a proxy, a puppet state of China, has been sending massive amounts of weapons from the very get-go, on Beijing's orders, clearly. So, you know, you've got a kind of Eurasian superpower now coalescing, China and Russia together, and we don't want that to happen. And one of the ways to stop that from happening is to stop Russian aggression and Chinese aggression, for that matter, against Taiwan and Iranian aggression against Israel. A lot of this is stoked by China itself. You understand, China is lighting fires around the world to deliberately disperse our forces and deplete our munitions. And guess what? It's working. We're running out of bullets.
Yeah, I mean, we got to have a major commitment to a mass military base, and we're just not doing it. I don't understand it. It would be a for-profit industry. I mean, Lithuania, Poland, Taiwan, they will pay for our stuff. So why don't we make more of our stuff? And that'll work as a deterrent to China. We have not made moves in that way. Does that surprise you?
Well, it does. And it also surprises me that only of late have we worried about some of the component parts on our weapon system coming from China. How can you be sourcing component parts from your principal adversary in the world, knowing in the event of a conflict that you won't have access to those parts? And maybe, who knows, they might contain, the chips might contain backdoors that allow remote access and on-off switches. So there are lots of vulnerabilities here about not having a robust defense industrial base, at least one that depends in, if it depends on anything, it has to depend on allies like Japan to work together with, not source goods and parts in China itself, which wants to replace us as the dominant power in the world and is working across all domains to achieve that end.
Right. So put it in perspective. Why do they want that? Why wouldn't they just compete, move up in the world, give their people a degree of freedom while staying communist where they were heading 10 years ago? Why does this work better for them, or does it?
Well, a couple of reasons here. One is that Xi Jinping is modeling himself on the first Red Emperor, Mao Zedong. And like Mao, he is a committed socialist. He's taking China once more down the socialist road to ruin. He's crushing the private sector of the economy. He's expanding the public sector of the economy. That never ends well economically, but it does increase his power. And as a megalomaniac, that's what he wants. He's getting older. And like Mao, he's becoming, I think, a little more paranoid in his old age. He's now demolished all the other factions within the Chinese Communist Party and reigns alone at the top of the power pyramid. So there's really no one to check or block him within China. Our systems are fundamentally incompatible. I mean, you've written books about the American founding, brilliant books. And we had a wonderful group of people, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, brilliant men who struck the most remarkable documents off the mind of men that have perhaps ever been struck, the Declaration of Independence and so forth. And in China, the polar opposite has occurred. The Chinese Communist Party is based on a philosophy of not love, but hate. Mao himself said that. Mao said, communism is not love. Communism is a hammer we use to crush the enemy. And they're still crushing the enemy in China. They're crushing the Uyghurs, the Christians, the Catholics, the Tibetan Buddhists, you name it. And of course, they like to crush their enemies abroad. They believe at the end of the day that only one of our countries will be left standing, and they intend for China to be the dominant power in the world. We have to wake up to this reality. And a lot of people are still not there.
Well, a lot of people in this administration are not there. They think they can deal with them. They're all proud that they have opened up a dialogue like they have a year ago. But I think in some degree, China would rather have Joe Biden win than Donald Trump win. And they're probably going to make sure that they don't do anything to cause that. Or am I thinking too much?
Well, you made me laugh there. Of course they'd want Joe Biden to win. Of course they want feckless, helpless, hopeless, hapless Joe Biden in the White House, who wakes up every morning not knowing what day it is. My goodness, there's no question about who China would prefer. And so I think we're looking here at a period of vulnerability between now and next January. We're looking here, I think, from the Chinese point of view, Chinese Communist Party's point of view, at an opportunity over the next 6 months to strike in the South China Sea, to strike against Taiwan, to take other aggressive action overseas. Because that window, in their view, may close on January of next year, depending on the outcome of the election. And you're right. I mean, we've still got toothless Janet Yellen, just spent 5 days in Beijing, talking about telling the Chinese that they had to stop overproducing. And once again, I just had to chuckle, because the whole Chinese approach to trade is mercantilistic. It's based on overproducing. It's based on beggaring thy neighbor. It's based on producing so many goods at below market prices that you drive your competitors out of business, and then you can raise prices because you've got a monopoly. That's what China's go-to plan has been on trade from the very get-go, manipulating its currency, flooding the market with cheap goods. And it's worked. And we've never done anything in response. Well, we did in 2018. Trump put tariffs on some Chinese goods. And to my great surprise, Biden has left those tariffs in place, but he hasn't increased them. And China has learned to work around that. So you can't go and jawbone China into compliance. Anything you suggest has to have real teeth. And I don't see the Biden administration biting China anytime soon.
But Steve, I did hear there's pushback to when things get bad, they dump all their products into the markets like ours in Europe. And Europe and the U.S. seem to be unified in saying you're not going to do it this time.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how that works out. We know that China's economy is in the tank. We know that the youth unemployment rate, the official youth unemployment rate, is 16%. A few months ago, it was 21%, but they redefined what unemployment was. Unemployment is no longer being at home without a job in China. Anyway, so 16%. The real youth unemployment rate is about 40%, maybe closer to 50%. So the economy is going downhill. The domestic sector of the economy is literally bankrupt. The big property development companies have gone under. There are 65 million apartments that now stand empty because people can't afford to buy them. There aren't enough people actually in China to buy them because of the one-child policy, killing off half of the last two generations. So tremendously overbuilt. The export sector of the economy is being forced back a step by the general economic, you know, downturn in the world at large. So China faces all kinds of headwinds. It faces demographic headwinds, a dying population. It faces economic headwinds, and it quite frankly, it's going once more down the socialist road to ruin, thanks to Xi Jinping, and that's kind of a trifecta of disasters.
So, do you think that if there wasn't a President Xi, that there'd be somebody else? Do you think he's a type of personality that's brought China in this the opposite direction we thought they were heading, or are they heading there and he just happens to be the leader?
Yeah, I think the system, the Chinese Communist Party Politburo, is a boiling cauldron of factional warfare, obscure to the West, but vicious when you're inside it. And this is the kind, Xi Jinping is the kind of person who naturally emerges at the top of that factional warfare. And so I think this system produces Xi Jinping's and Mao Zedong's the same way that, you know, McDonald's produces hamburgers. This is normally what you get. And the only reason we got a reformist like Deng Xiaoping, and remember, he was an economic reformist. He wasn't a political reformist. He wanted the Chinese Communist Party to stay in absolute control. But he realized that China, by the time that Mao had died, was in absolute dire straits, that, you know, 50 million people had died in the Mao famine after the Great Leap Forward. The Cultural Revolution had been a disaster. He had to do something, and he turned to America and said, help. And we did help. We opened our markets to Chinese goods. We invested billions and billions of dollars in China startup factories. And we also sent over technology, cutting-edge technology, on the assumption that China was going to go our way, that if we stretched out a helping hand, that China would reciprocate, that political change would follow. And it hasn't. China remains a brutal one-party dictatorship. It's really the world's first high-tech digital dictatorship where the state is watching everybody.
So, Steve, exit question, by the way, starting to Steve Mosher, president of the Population Research Institute, best-selling author, his newest book, The Devil and the Communist China, From Mao to President to Xi. So, Steve, overall, do you believe that China's needs to take Taiwan almost for their industrial base, or they just want them out there? They want a communist Taiwan so no people realize that there is a better way than their way. I mean, they see right off their coast this democracy that's so productive that it gives people a quality of life that just doesn't exist in red China. Is that the problem, the example it does, or do they need the economic engine?
Oh, that's not an either-or question. That's a both-and question. China would like to capture TSMC, the largest chip manufacturer in the world. Taiwan manufactures 90-some percent of the world's chips. China would like that manufacturing capability. But you also said, quite correctly, Taiwan is a beacon of freedom. There you've got 24 million Chinese who have successfully put in place a democracy where human rights are respected, where you have freedom of speech, assembly, association, all the other. You have successful transitions of power, 6 presidential elections, passing the ultimate test of a democracy, the peaceful transition of power from one party to another. So, yeah, they'd like to kill that beacon of freedom, lest the virus of democracy spread to China itself. And Xi Jinping would like to fight the last battle of the Chinese Civil War.
Chinese civil war, yeah. Chiang Kai-shek is long gone, but his people are still running Taiwan. And it's now more than ever. It's not clear if Japan would defend them. It's not clear if we're going to defend them. It depends on what day it is. It's ambiguity. Steve Mosher, congratulations on the book. Pick it up to get a perspective on what China really wants and what they're up to, the devil and communist China. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, when we come back, I'll be able to squeeze in some of your calls, and I appreciate everybody listening. By the way, if you want to see me in person, and who wouldn't, how about April 27th? Go to Henderson, Nevada, right outside Las Vegas. We're going to do Liberty, History, Liberty, and Laughs. We have a great time on stage. You get to have a chance to interact with you, talk about the political landscape. Most of all the books that I have that you can order at any time at briankilmeade.com and get them personalized for Mother's Day. But I'll just talk about history through time leading up to my latest book, Teddy and Booker T, and still have a great time. You listen to The Brian Kilmeade Show. Go to briankilmeade.com right now.
Learning something new every day on The Brian Kilmeade Show. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
The University of Iowa announced that basketball star Caitlin Clark will have her jersey retired and replaced with an apron. Well, the WNBA draft is this Monday, and Iowa star Caitlin Clark is expected to be the number one pick. Here to comment is Caitlin Clark. But nothing for my joke, whatever. I am a fan, Caitlin, by the way.
Really, Michael? Because I heard that little apron joke you did.
And she went on. It was pretty funny. She came out. She's going to be the number one pick in the draft tonight, I think, in Brooklyn. So that'll be cool. She's going to supposed to go to Indianapolis, which will be great. By the way, we're going to be in Indianapolis at the end of June. I wonder if we'll see her. She had fun on set. It was actually a fun show. Michael Chaso has an array of jokes that he always makes about women's sports in a fun way. So Caitlin Carr called him out on it. And here's a little more. Cut 45.
You make a lot of jokes about women's sports, don't you, Michael?
I wouldn't say a lot, but, you know, it's not on the regular.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a lot. I actually sort of made a supercut. Take a look.
Well, no, we don't have to do that.
A number of sports bars around the country are promising to only show women's basketball games during March Madness. The bars are known collectively as the Empty Ones. A new report claims that recent stories on the Sports Illustrated website were actually generated by AI. And it's already making glaring mistakes. For instance, it made up something called the WNBA. Iowa's Final Four game against UConn was the most watched women's college basketball game ever, with 14.2 million viewers, beating the previous record by 14.2 million viewers.
Wow. Call with the receipts. Thanks, man.
No problem. You know, unlike Che, I support women.
Whoa! No, hold on. I think you're a great basketball player. I mean, I can't play like you do.
Yeah, we know. And obviously, I can't tell jokes like you do.
Thank you for that.
So they went back. But it was very funny. They were just having fun. It was all good. And she has a really good personality. That's the way you put the show used to be, right? Responding to the news. They had a little thing in the beginning of the cold open. It was just making fun of Oppenheimer and the Barbie movie.
Oh, that was the monologue with Jake Gyllenhaal and Emily Blunt. It was fantastic because Emily Blunt was in Oppenheimer. Gyllenhaal was in Barbie.
They're together in this new movie.
Which
does not look good.
I mean, it's a different kind of movie, right? It's like PG-13 sort of. It's like, I think, like over the top sort of. Seems like Deadpool-esque, but I just saw the trailer of it.
Right. But he seems to get beat up and some type of misunderstanding.
Yeah. But I will say the two of them are insanely talented.
Individually. Have they been on movies together?
I'm sure they have at some point. I can't recall though off the top of my head. But between the acting and them both singing in that monologue, I know you love singing.
No, I'm amazed. I did not know he could sing until that Barbie movie. Did you?
No.
Okay.
I'm sure he can do anything.
Which, I didn't see the Barbie movie, but I've seen him sing in the Barbie movie.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. 1-866-408-7669. We have a lot to discuss today, a lot of things breaking. We're riding with it. It's kind of dramatic this morning as you saw the President of the United States, former President of the United States, go out of Trump Tower, hop in a huge caravan of SUVs as they went down the FDR's drive and then went across town to the courthouse. And that's where the president is at this moment. He did speak to the press prior. And also the prime minister of Iraq is also in town. And that's going to be an impactful meeting because, you know, the Iraqis, the Iranians have tremendous influence there. One of the biggest mistakes that's underreported, in my view, was when Barack Obama takes office, the surge worked. It's totally calm in Iraq. And he pulls all of our troops out. Little by little, Iran starts coming in, and this group called ISIS, who we didn't even hear of back then, but they, Barack Obama, he says, on the recommendation of, get this, Lloyd Austin, then a four-star general, called them the JV team. Just because they have a Lakers jersey doesn't mean they play as well as Kobe Bryant. So guess who gave them that information? Lloyd Austin, the current Secretary of Defense. So because of that, we had to go back into Iraq and actually work with the same objective with Iran, and that is get rid of ISIS. And then we're still there in Syria. We're still there, 2,500 troops in Iraq. And now the Iraqis are getting pressure from Iran. Get rid of the U.S. They don't want to. So that's some of the back and forth that's going today, especially it looks like that some of those rockets, those missiles, those drones were launched out of Iraq. Think about that. So this hour, I'm going to be joined by Senator Joni Ernst, a former Air Force pilot. She is also very concerned about our stance, not only in Ukraine, but what we're doing now and not doing with Israel. We really look at them as the bad guy. I don't know how this all got twisted. So let's talk about what happened over the weekend. I was able to come in and we had a special edition of One Nation was on a little bit later than normal. But we were able to cover the breaking news and that for a couple of hours, it looks as though over 300 ballistic missiles, cruise missiles, as well as drones were sent into Israel. Now, keep in mind, some of them were en route to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is full of Muslims. Are they going to kill Palestinians too? So U.S. destroyed more than 80 drones and at least six ballistic missiles from Iran and Yemen. They knocked them down. Only one, I think, hit the ground. It was shrapnel. 300 drones and missiles were knocked out by the U.K., the U.S., of course, the Arrow missile defense system, the Iron Dome, as well as David Sling. All together, short-term, long-term, they knocked them out of the sky. To me, it took a U.K., U.S., French, Jordanian effort, as well as Israel effort, predominantly Israel, to knock all these out of the sky. They say, take the win. President Biden says, take the win. Iran now normalized hitting on soil. From their soil to Israel, so they normalize it. No longer can they say Hezbollah and Hamas does their own thing. Yeah, we finance, but they do their own thing. They're for the Palestinians. It is now Iran against Israel. Do you think that they should feel a compunction to strike back? I say absolutely they should strike back. Frank McKenzie does not agree with us. Remember, the general, now retired, writing a book, coming out, trying to restore his image. He might be a great guy or a great general. What I first got exposed to him was the ridiculous, a horrible evacuation from Afghanistan. Here's what he said and was recommendation. He said on Saturday night, on Sunday, cut 18.
I think one of the opportunities for the victor in a major battle that was just fought that Israel won is the opportunity to use restraint. And I would counsel restraint. There will be voices that will urge Israelis to take out the Iranian nuclear program, which I think is a false chimera anyway. But I would argue that if you're going to do something, and they may have to do something, I would be precise. I would be short. The fact of the matter is Israel can name the price they want to exact. The wide gap between Iranian zealotry and enthusiasm and Israeli competence has now been laid bare for all to see. So the Israelis will be able to do what they want. But sometimes when you're in that position, showing some restraint is the best strategic option that you can take.
Right. Of course, everybody says restraint. You know, when Hamas goes in and massacres 2,200 people, well, you guys have overreacted in Gaza. Really? Okay. They massacred and kidnapped your people. Evidently, 130 hostages down to 20. So they basically killed and tortured some Americans, as well as some internationals, as well as Israelis predominantly. Took totally innocent people, but it's up to Israel to show restraint. I understand More is expected of them. And I understand that we have their weapons. We supply most of their weapons. I get that. But they're the ones in the hostile neighborhood who don't attack anyone, but only attacked after being intact. So General McKenzie did point out something else. Hamas really didn't use any rockets, and Hezbollah didn't ratchet up their rockets. And they got 150,000, according to reports, over in Lebanon. Cut 19.
I don't think Israel can shrug it off, because I think Israel still needs to be concerned about Lebanese Hezbollah up north in Lebanon. They do have the ability to hurt Israel if they come into the fight. Interesting, last night there was some tactical back and forth in the northern border, but nothing like the volume of fires that LH, Lebanese Hezbollah, could have generated had they wanted to come into the fight. The fact that they did not choose to do so is, I think, very, very important. It's a very important thing to note, because they know and understand what Israel can do to them.
So I just don't understand. Lloyd Austin comes out and he says, I just want to say we're not at war with Iran. Okay. We didn't know anything about the taking out of the 7 IRGC. All right. We do not support Israel if they're going to go hit Iran. Okay. You don't have to go tell the world. Why are we so scared of Iran thinking that we're at war with them when they basically have been at war with us on some level since 1979? They are the problem. I mean, sometimes people go, the Middle East, where do you go? The place. It's really not confusing anymore. They know Israel's not the problem. They know Iran's the problem. You might say, well, there's a problem in Yemen. That's Israel. Excuse me, that's Iran. Oh, there's a problem in Syria. Well, mostly it's Iran. Well, there's a problem in Lebanon. That's Hezbollah supported by Iran. Well, there's a problem in Gaza. That is Iran supporting Hamas. So if you got rid of this regime, I don't want a democracy. If you got rid of the very unpopular government in Iran, these problems go away. Abraham Accords were about to kick in with Saudi Arabia. Remember, Brett Baer was doing an interview with the prince, interview with Netanyahu. They were ready to normalize relations. It still might happen. But all we hear is ratchet it back. Why? Because this administration, Joe Biden's got terrible instincts on foreign policy. He's got experience. It doesn't mean he's got great instincts. Number two, he knows domestically only 32% of Democrats say they support giving Israel weapons. Before the war started, before January 7th, it was only at 47%. So now Joe Biden's saying, I'm losing to Donald Trump, and I'm losing Michigan to Donald Trump. I might lose Minnesota to Donald Trump. I'm losing some people in Wisconsin due to Donald Trump. And why? Because the Palestinian, Arab, Muslim vote is leaving Joe Biden. Well, if Joe Biden actually wanted to do something savvy, maybe he can go, if you have a problem with my policy, Donald Trump is all in on Israel to the point where he was the most pro-Israel president ever. But yeah, they won't do that. Among the people that give me hope, besides Bill Maher at times, is John Fetterman. And he is thoroughly in Israel's court. Cut 20.
I think it really demonstrates how it's astonishing that we are not standing firmly with Israel, and there should never be any kinds of conditions on all of that. When a nation can launch hundreds of drones towards Israel, and I'm not going to be talking about conditions ever.
Right. He went on. Cut 21.
A senior administration official tells CNN that President Biden told Prime Minister Netanyahu that the U.S. will not participate in any offensive operations against Iran. Do you think that's the right call, or should direct U.S. military action, as some of your colleagues in the Senate are suggesting, should that be on the table?
I don't agree with that, you know, and I just think we should follow and have Israel's back in the situation. I don't agree with the president. That doesn't change anything that he's a fantastic president, and I'm proud to stand with him and campaign for him and vote for him.
He doesn't agree with that there. He doesn't agree with them in Ukraine. He thinks he should give them all the weapons they need to be successful. He's willing to take on the protesters. Do you know the protesters blocked a key road into downtown Chicago today? Pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas, anti-Israel protesters. So I want to talk a little bit about 2024. So what's going to happen, and what has happened, is 93% to 97% of Republicans have consolidated around Donald Trump. They have said he's the guy. Donald Trump has used his power in the House. He's used his power in the Senate. He has basically using his people and his surrogates to set up a government because he thinks he's going to win. And the polls show he's got an excellent chance to do it. I never remember him leading in 2016 and 2020. You could say he's more popular now than he ever was, despite the fact he got four criminal trials, three of which seem to be in a delay of game, but one is actually active today. So when you get people who say, wait a second, you see him indicted, you heard about January 6th, you see the speech he made, you see the second impeachment, how could you be supporting them? Now, they don't want to come and say that because they know 70-plus million and more are going to vote for him again. And they see right now his report card for 3.5 years, despite the Russian investigation, the ridiculous impeachment that took place, and in two impeachments overall, the ripping up of the State of the Union address, all this stuff that said he wasn't a legitimate president, they said it nonstop until 2020 happened. And they said, oh, you won in 2016. You lost in 2020. So now when people go and you have a candidate or you run and you lose, for the most part, whether you're Senator Bradley losing to Al Gore, whether you're Pat Buchanan losing to George W. Bush, whether you're George H.W. Bush losing to Reagan, whether you're McCain losing to Bush, what happens is you go with your party. Unless it's really, really bitter, you support your party. And Ted Cruz was slow to do it, but now he is all in. Marco Rubio was all in. Jeb Bush didn't do it, but he didn't go out against Trump. So when Chris Sununu was all for Nikki Haley and saying that Donald Trump gives them the best chance to win, and then he said, oh, yeah, I told you already. If Nikki Haley loses, I will support Trump. So when he goes on with George Stephanopoulos, he's unbelievably competent, can do it. But George Stephanopoulos is absolutely relentless. You know that he played a role in his speech, helped propel January 6th. You talked about the insurrection. You talked about all these bad things that he did. But yet you're still going to vote for him. So this thing went on for 7 minutes. And I don't even know where to cut it. But here's a small excerpt. And I wrote Chris Sununu this morning, and he wrote me back, and I'll share it with you. Wait a second. Can I? I didn't ask him. I can't, right? Eric is saying no. All right. Well, you know what? We'll play the soundbite. I'll text him. So I asked him about this. So I watched this. And just know there's another 5 minutes of this. Cut 38.
And you believe that a president who contributed to an insurrection should be president again?
As does 51% of America, George. I mean, really, I understand you're part of the media. I understand you're in this New York City bubble or whatever it is. But you got to look around what's happening across this country. It's not about just supporting Trump. It's getting rid of what we have today. It's about understanding inflation is crushing families. It's understanding that this border issue is not a Texas issue. It's a 50-state issue, right? That has to be brought under control. It's about that type of elitism that the average American is just sick and tired of. And it's a culture change. That's what I'm supporting. That's what most of America right now is looking to support and wants to change there. So again, I know you're shocked that the Republican governor is supporting a Republican president and a Republican ticket, but it's about the ticket. It's about up and down the ballot.
He said it all along. And by the way, his dad knows he's the president's a little unorthodox. He's a big classical Republican, former chief of staff to H.W. Bush, John Sununu. And he was for Trump. He was on all the time. And he talks to, by the way, Governor Chris Sununu talks to his dad all the time about this. So he was just relentless. They paid cuts of him going to bat for Governor Haley and saying that Donald Trump, with all these court cases, would be a huge distraction. Because it is. But it's all built into it. This is a reality show. And this is all built into it. He's saying with Donald Trump comes a Tim Scott, comes a Marco Rubio, comes a John Ratcliffe, comes a Mike Pompeo, comes maybe a Governor Nikki Haley, comes a Lindsey Graham. There's other people that are involved that begin to win and have influence. Tom Cotton in the Senate. You'll see people have influence be elevated. The Senate will go to Republicans, and the president could start changing the culture, lessening regulations, pumping up natural gas production, as well as oil production responsibly, going to take on China, not let Iran and Russia and China run roughshod through South and Central America, telling people in the Middle East, you mess with us, you're going to pay a price. And then I don't love the president's sensibilities when it comes to Ukraine. But the people around him get it, and hopefully people like General Keane and others will work with him. Because this president, we've already seen Secretary of State Blinken, we've seen Jake Sullivan. Does anybody want more of this? That's what he's trying to say. And for George Stephanopoulos to be stuck on January 6th is just astounding to me. And it shouldn't be, because he did the same thing with Nancy Mace. He doesn't want to host a show. He doesn't want to work on Sundays. He's whining. He looked exhausted. So don't let him do it. You just take his name off it. I mean, Martha Raddatz hates Trump, but at least you could ask a different question. Why even book a Republican if you're just going to keep on talking about January 6th? Who are you rewarding? Fareed Zakaria? These are by people that just can't get off the fact, Peggy Noonan too, that Donald Trump won and is winning again despite everybody else expressing the disdain and how unworthy he is for office. You know what's the best sales tool for Donald Trump? It was Joe Biden. I'm not saying that Trump locked it up by any stretch, but the best seal, the best sell for Donald Trump is Joe Biden, just by his actions. I'll come back and take your calls, and then we'll have Senator Joni Ernst at the bottom of the hour. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're also following the latest things. If any news comes out of the courtroom, we'll bring it to you. Any news comes out of the president's meeting with the prime minister of Iraq, we'll bring that to you, too. Don't move.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Everything about this case is, in my view, legally absurd. You know, this case is basically a state misdemeanor that had run out on the statute of limitations. And Bragg was forced, after he declined for a long time to bring this charge, to do so. His predecessor rejected it. You have this crazy case that's going to go forward, and it's going to turn on the testimony of people like Michael Cohen. And Michael Cohen just recently had a judge call him a serial perjurer. Wow. And he's going to appear as the center of this case.
That is so cool. By the way, don't be deflated by the music, but we are coming up against a break. Let's go out to Australia. Benjamin's there. Hey, Benjamin.
Hi, Brian. So I just think, you know, if the Israelis are going to attack back now, the only thing they really should try to hit is to do with Iran's nuclear program, because I think now the Iranians can make like 3 nuclear bombs, so they might as well just, you know, kind of.
Hey, Benjamin, I talked to two military officials. They believe that if they had nuclear weapons, they would have used them this weekend. So I'm not sure they have 3. I have not heard that, but you're right. If they could penetrate and blow that up, that they should absolutely do it. I also think the drone factory would be great, because the drones are the one really tilting the war against the Ukrainians. It would also be great if we funded the Ukrainians, too. And of course, there was Benjamin. I was just in Australia. Could not be more impressed with your country. I was sad to see the shooting over the weekend in Sydney. I was actually at that very block. My daughter was at school there where the shooting took place. But you had a hero cop take the shooter down, which is great. When we come back, I'm going to talk to Senator Joni Ernst, and then I'm going to end with all your calls. So get online, the order in which you received. I will get to you. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's hard to take a look at what President Biden has done and say that we've somehow gone soft on Iran. It was the previous administration that decided to get us out of the Iran deal. And now Iran is so much dramatically closer to a potential nuclear weapon capability than they were before Mr. Trump was elected.
So obviously that is Admiral Kirby. He's spinning it the way they want to. It bothers me. I don't want a regional war. I don't want a world war. But I see this problem only getting worse. Iran's only going to get more powerful. Hamas is only going to get more rockets if they're able to survive. Hezbollah is only going to get more formidable, at which time we might have a generation grow up, which we're seeing right now with Democrats, who have no interest in defending Israel. I mean, right now, only 32% of Democrats support sending more arms to Israel. You have a former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who says we should cut them off. Senator Joni Ernst understands who our real allies are of Iowa and joins us now. Senator, welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much, Brian. Wow, did we have quite a weekend, huh?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was telegraphed. But you understand better than I. I mean, for our fighter jets to get in the sky and knock drones out and cruise missiles out blows me away. For us to have missile defense and coordinate with the UK, with Jordan, with the French, as well as the Israelis, I mean, that it can't be overstated how impressive that is.
It is very impressive, and kudos to the men and women that make this work, our men and women that wear the nation's uniform. Thank God for them. Thank God for partners and allies across the Middle East that also decided to defend Israel and engage against Iran. This is incredibly important that we continue to lead on the world stage. And this is where the Biden administration has been extremely weak, Brian, and we could not have it any longer. They need to stand firmly with Israel, and we need to give a what for to Iran. We have got to, first, in the short term, be supporting Israel, providing them the weapons and munitions that they need. In the long term, there have to be consequences to Iran's actions, and we should start by cutting off their oil revenues and actually enforcing
sanctions. How would we do that? Senator, how would we do that? Well, because China's buying, right?
So glad you asked. Yes. So I do have a bipartisan bill here in the Senate. It's Blumenthal and I are sponsoring that bill. It's the Iran Sanctions Enforcement Act. There is another bipartisan bill mirroring that over in the House, which is led by August Pfluger of Texas and Jimmy Panetta of California. So Republicans and Democrats working together to force the administration to enforce the sanctions. And then once those sanctions are enforced, we start seizing Iranian oil. The revenues from downloading and selling that oil will roll right into our Department of Homeland Security Investigations Office, which further strengthens our ability to intercept illicit oil coming out of Iran. Now, the administration, they've got the sanctions out there. They're just not enforcing. And the excuse they're using, Brian, is, well, we don't have the money to enforce the sanctions. Well, folks, this will give you the revenues to do so. And then anything left over, we can always apply to our national debt. But we've got to do it. Don't just talk the talk. We've got to walk the walk.
Well, and there's got to be willingness to do it. It's not like they can't think creative enough. They don't believe it. They believe that you guys had it, the Republicans had it absolutely backwards, that we should go ahead and get a nuclear deal with Iran and don't worry about the neighbors. Trump went in there and said, no, we're going to isolate Iran and we're going to cut a deal with the neighbors where they recognize Israel, called the Abraham Accords. It's not hard to figure out. Everywhere you look, in Yemen, Iran is the problem. In Syria, Iran is the problem. In Lebanon, Iran is the problem. In Gaza, Iran is the problem. This is not a bunch of countries. It's only one supporting terrorist groups there, all pointing at Israel. So knowing that what we just saw, this might be a moment. And I talked to Adam Bowler. He says act with speed. And I talked to General Perkins. He says take your time. So I'm wondering, with your military background, what do you think Israel should do?
Well, I think they do need to get it right, and the tide has turned. We have had so many people, friends, allies, that are really down on Israel just for trying to defend themselves. But after this weekend's actions by Iran, we see the world yet once again coming together to support Israel. They can now see clearly the problem, which you just outlined, Brian. It's Iran. It's Iran, Iran, Iran. So I do think there have to be repercussions to Iran for their attacks on Israel. First time ever direct attacks on Israel coming from Iran. But I think they should work on this momentum as well, gain as many solid partners as possible before they go in and put to use those repercussions. So, but I'm going to go back on Admiral Kirby. I'm sorry, Admiral Kirby, but what the Democrats were doing with that Iran nuclear deal was just in enabling Iran and providing them with billions of dollars that were used to fund those drones and ballistic missiles that have attacked Israel and not only Israel, but American troops on the ground throughout the Middle East as well. The money that went into those drones, think about those three soldiers from the 718th Engineer Company out of Georgia, great reserve soldiers that were killed at Tower 22 in Jordan. They were killed by drones that were paid for by Iran. So this needs to stop.
Right.
The Democrats have got to get it right. We've got to be tough against Iran.
Well, the thing is, too, this is what's different now. Even if you say that's even and you decide not to act and Prime Minister Netanyahu buckles to President Biden or he chooses on his own volition, things have changed now. So when they do target more IRGCs in the next Soleimani, they say, well, we're going to hit you back on your soil. Now we're going to accept it, as was brought up to me over the weekend. They said, you know, in the beginning when Hamas used to send rockets, they used to fall harmlessly to the ground. They said, what's the big deal? Now it's part of their daily life, and the Iron Dome's constantly, prior to invasion, was constantly activated. Hezbollah, they once in a while used to send rockets. Now it's constant. Now are we to suspect that Iran's going to, they're going to get used to Iran constantly sending cruise missiles, constantly sending drones over Israel every time they do something they don't like?
This is unacceptable, Brian, absolutely unacceptable that Israelis are living in fear every single day. Thank God for the Iron Dome and other measures that have been put into place. We have a number of Arab allies, friends that are working with Israel, as you pointed out, through the Abraham Accords. My Defend Act was part of that vision to bring interconnectivity between air defense mechanisms throughout the Middle East. That is working. I'm glad it was signed into law. It allows Jordan, others, Saudi Arabia has been assisting with those drones, too. This is really, really important. But the Israelis should not have to live like this, Brian. This would be unacceptable here in the United States to have other countries attacking us continuously. It shouldn't be acceptable in the Middle East as well.
Well, I want you to hear what Matthew Miller said last month when asked about the unfrozen money that Iran is getting. Remember, the $6 billion that was in South Korea, cut 12.
Not only is it not our assessment that that's not what how this money is used, but it's not what we have seen during the provision of this waiver in the past. And again, what we have seen, and this is borne out time and time again, is that Iran is always going to fund terrorism. It's always going to fund destabilizing activities. That is the first item it commits to when Iran is going through whatever budget process it is that Iran goes through.
Have you ever saw such an idiotic assessment? So give them more money? You say, well, they're using the $6 billion for my humanitarian needs, but then they're just going to fund terrorism anyway. You cut down the amount of money they have, that's less money for terrorism.
Well, exactly, Brian, and let's start choking them out. This, again, it's unacceptable that we continue to turn a blind eye to their bad activities. You know, we've got to get strong. Iran's oil revenue, because we're not enforcing sanctions, it's at a five-year high. $80 billion that directly funds Iran's war machine. And again, those drones and missiles that are being used to attack Israel and to attack and kill Americans overseas. So let's get serious about this, Mr. President. You know how this works. So wake up. The only reason they don't see it is because they're not opening their eyes.
Couple of things. Where do you stand legislatively? I understand things are gummed up in the House. They're looking to put out 16 different pieces of legislation, possibly funding of Israel funding alone, possibly doing Ukraine funding alone, possibly doing it combined. Republicans are all over the place on this, Senator. What do you think is going to happen? And time does matter in both wars, right?
Time matters. Absolutely, it does. And I will just remind Americans, too, that this is about national security. Now, I've already voted on the supplemental here in the United States Senate. I voted for it because I believe not only is Israel important, but I also believe that countering China in the South Pacific and the, you know, the China, South China Sea is really important as well, and Ukraine. Now, if we see Russia roll through Ukraine and they start encroaching on NATO, then it is our sons and daughters that will be engaged in that fight, folks. We need to make sure that the Ukrainians are pushing Russia out now. This is so important to our own national security and for the preservation of our future generations. I believe it is all extremely important.
So Donald Trump's on trial today, first criminal trial. I don't know, you don't have time to dive knee deep into it, but from what you know, do you think this is something that should be taking place?
Oh, for heaven's sakes, no, Brian. This is absolutely outrageous. The former president shouldn't be going through this. We know it's all a political ploy. I think it's just, it's an embarrassment that they're actually trying to proceed with this. But again, this is a witch hunt for the former president.
So if you ever go on, I don't know if you, do you go on with the ABC with George Stephanopoulos?
I don't. I haven't.
Well, he's obsessed. There, he, like many, are obsessed with January 6th. That's all he wants to talk about. So Governor Sununu, who used to was supporting Nikki Haley, now supports Trump. And Stephanopoulos can't believe it. Listen to this exchange, Cut 38.
And you believe that a president who contributed to an insurrection should be president again?
As does 51% of America, George. I mean, really, I understand you're part of the media. I understand you're in this New York City bubble or whatever it is. But you got to look around what's happening across this country. It's not about just supporting Trump. It's getting rid of what we have today. It's about understanding inflation is crushing families. It's understanding that this border issue is not a Texas issue. It's a 50-state issue, right? That has to be brought under control. It's about that type of elitism that the average American is just sick and tired of. And it's a culture change. That's what I'm supporting. That's what most of America right now is looking to support and wants to change there. So again, I know you're shocked that the Republican governor is supporting a Republican president and a Republican ticket, but it's about the ticket. It's about up and down the ballot.
Do you understand where he's coming from?
Absolutely, I do. You know, this is a fall and a general election where Republicans absolutely must win. We need Donald Trump in the White House. We need the House to remain in Republican hands with hopefully a wider majority. And this is an outstanding year for Republicans to take back the Senate with all of these incredible candidates that we have across the United States. It is that important for our constituencies that are suffering under Bidenomics, excessive inflation. They see the threat of war all around them because Biden is so darn weak-kneed. He just can't even get our allies together. It takes all of these atrocities happening around the world to rally all of these other countries. We have a world that is falling apart, and it's all because of Joe Biden and the Democrats that continue to support him.
All right. We'll see. I know you have Larry Hogan is doing well in Maryland. Looks like Senator Tim Sheehy is going to give Test a role he can handle. People think that Jim Justice has won already in West Virginia. And then you got to see what's going to happen with Dave McCormick in Pennsylvania. And I think there's going to be a tough fight over in Ohio. So a lot of these Democrats know how to pretend to be moderate come election time. But to be totally candid, the only moderates were Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin.
Yes, and we know now that neither will be returning to Congress. We need to replace them with good, strong Republicans. We need to gain the majority. We absolutely must do that. And thankfully, we've got all the right candidates.
All right, Senator, you're out in front with your military background. It's invaluable right now. So I hope you continue to use your voice. Senator Joni Ernst, thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Have a great day.
Yep, she's also on Armed Services, obviously. Listen, I'll come back. We're going to finish up strong. I'll try to get to the phones. And also your emails, briankilmeade.com. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at briankilmeadeshow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up. From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. Got a few minutes here. Just a quick announcement. I got to look up the other date. Do you remember the other date, Allison?
Reading your mind, you mean when you're going to be live in Indianapolis, Indiana? It will be June 29th.
June 29th, good. Yes. So I'll be in Indianapolis June 29th. We just put it up. It's already selling well. History, Liberty, and Laughs Tour. Chance to talk about all my books on stage and interact with people. And best off, if you get VIP tickets, I get to meet before and have a chance to answer all your questions. And a lot of it veers right into politics. And then Green Valley Ranch, Grand Event Center, and Henderson, Nevada, right outside Las Vegas. We're flying into Las Vegas on the 26th, and we'll do the show on the 27th. And if you want to see what it's like, you have an idea, it's on Fox Nation. If you go there, you're going to get a couple of 6 months free was last time. Do you know if we're given 6 months or is it? Have they decided yet? It's up to...
It should be. I'm waiting on that to get confirmed. But yeah. I mean, that's just a perk. You should go anyway.
Yeah, right? You should go anyway. But the Fox Nation, who has so many of our great features on there, and they post up some of the live shows afterwards, and What Made America Great have 56 episodes of different great parts of our history. And it's a motivational, patriotic, inspirational night on stage. So hopefully you'll see us out there. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. So, and then Indianapolis just got posted. That'll be at the Shelton Auditorium, 1000 West 42nd Street in Indianapolis, Indiana. It'll be right at the end of June, June 29th. And I have to navigate through all the personal things. I know it starts the summer for a lot of people. Hopefully you'll find some time to come out. I'd love to meet you all in person. We're watching the latest on the Trump trial. We watched him go out during lunch, and we saw him get in the morning. He gave a quick speech before he went in. He looks thoroughly ticked off, does the former president, about this case and where it's going and who's going to be testifying with him, who's going to be testifying against him. For me, this case is such a mystery because not having a law degree, I didn't think it was possible to charge somebody and not tell them what the charges are. But that's exactly what happened. I want you to hear Kate Cherkosky, a former federal prosecutor, talk about this trial. Cut nine.
The judge in this case has already said that anybody who self-identifies as somebody that cannot be fair and impartial up front will not even be questioned further. So that will weed out a significant amount of people who are openly partisan, as it were. We want people who are going to be listening to the evidence in this case and understanding the very high burden of proof that the prosecution has here, because this is not an easy case for the prosecution. And people that are not openly political, obviously, is a significant factor here as well. So I believe jury selection is going to take a long time in this case. We'll see if they can get a fair jury.
All right. It's going to be interesting. Going to be fascinating. Can you imagine if he actually gets off in New York City where he got 15% of the vote? You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Always, BrianKilmeade.com. Find out where to get any of my books signed, sealed, and sent.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network, subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.